There's an old adage, you plant potatoes, you get potatoes. I wanted to make sure I got potatoes. So I did everything I can to raise them properly. They hated it, but now they're adults and they appreciate it. All right.
1914, the war begins in the West. There was an attempt to maintain fluidity, but after the race to the sea, everything bogged down and it became a static war. 1915, that was in the West. In the East, of course, we know that it was chaos and the Russians were slowly losing.
1915, there were attempts to break the static warfare and return fluidity in the West. But the operations were relatively small scale because, again, they're learning. They're trying to figure out this new type of warfare.
In the East, that's really when Russia kind of just lost everything. And thanks to the emergence of Hindenburg, they managed to carve out Galicia, or today we call it Poland. And they had the Russians on their heels.
1916 would be an attempt to apply the lessons of 1914 and 15 by doing the same damn things that they did in the year before. All right.
As winter of 1915 sets in, and by the way, during World War I, they, for the most part, stopped major military operations during the winter. Because it was just logistically impossible to fight. So when the battling subside, the general staff in Berlin is sitting there trying to figure out where are we going to stage an attack. They did the full-blown analysis. If they attack the French trench systems, they saw how the German trench systems were basically able to stop both the British and the French attempts to penetrate. So they were afraid as if they attacked, they would be stopped. In other words, wasting men, wasting materiel. But they knew if they waited, the Entente strength is only going to grow because now Germany doesn't have its colonies, whereas France and England does. So while all the white guys may start dying off, these countries can be bringing in their territorial soldiers. So the longer the war went on, disadvantaged Germany. If they focused on the Russian front, the Eastern Front, they knew they could easily drive the Russians back, but as the Russians retreated, all you're doing is stretching your lines of supply. And you're just conquering vast acreage of open space. If they attacked Salonika, well, that would be useless because that's a tiny little front. And, oh my God, they're going to kick them out of southern Serbia. Whoop-de-freaking-do. Greece is neutral. That's not going to accomplish anything. This, of course, is when they're planning also the Battle of Jutland.
So where are we going to go? Well, at this time, the chief military planner was Falkenhayn. And Falkenhayn, as you may recall, was a Westerner.
He believed victory could only be achieved by having a victory in the West. Because going all the way back to Schlieffen, you knock France out of the war, then it would allow you to concentrate your strength on the Russians. Because with no France, England would retreat.
Make sense? All right. Plus, adding to this was the fact that they realized after the Second Battle of Champagne, the French fighting strength was greatly diminished.
I mean, literally, they ran out of artillery shells. Literally, at certain times, they ran out of bullets. And they lost tens of thousands of men. So, knowing that the French could be exhausted, Falkenhayn devises a plan to bring this war of attrition to a logical conclusion. What happens if we bleed them dry?
In the infamous Christmas memorandum, which Falkenhayn sent to Wilhelm II, Falkenhayn lays out his plan. He envisions a massive attack on a limited French position. So we're going to go all in on one point. This massive assault would force the French to throw everything they had to stop the breakthrough. So, Falkenhayn wanted to launch an attack that had nothing to do about gaining territory. He wasn't interested in moving the line, but rather he wanted to start a hot point where the French essentially would jump into the fire. To use his phrase, he wanted to bleed the French, his words, bleed them white. With the French neutered, he also envisioned a simultaneous move by sea against the Brits to force the Brits to abandon the French. Submarines. He called for the implementation of what would become unrestricted submarine warfare. Because England is an island. And you, if you unleash your untersea boats, your U-boats, and you sink everything going to England, England eventually will run out of food. And a nation can't fight if it has no food. He essentially would bring total war to the next level. Now, FYI, in the Kaiser's reply, he kind of agreed with the first point, but he was completely opposed to the second point, which I mentioned when I was talking about the Battle of Jutland. Just a few months before the Lusitania was sunk, and the last thing the Kaiser wanted to do was get the Americans involved. And he was afraid of unrestricted submarine warfare. So, with the Kaiser's blessing, he began scouring the map. And as he looked along the 600 or so mile front, scanning what was in the immediate vicinity all along the lines, he noticed the city of Verdun, right in this little bulge. And he said, Verdun was an ancient city that sat in a river valley surrounded by high hills. If he could capture half of the hills, he could use his artillery and rain death down upon the French. So, in planning this operation, he informed the Kaiser that the object of the Battle of Verdun would not be to defeat the French. He wouldn't ever try to take the city, but rather to use the advance as the means to create a meat grinder, where wave after wave after wave of French soldiers would be annihilated. His plan called for killing 4 French for every 1 German. If you are losing men at a ratio of 4-1, your people will lose the will to fight. They will demand surrender. Look at what happened to our country during Vietnam. And by the way, Falkenhayn planned to unleash such hell that this meat grinder would become so desolate, again, his words, that not even a mouse could survive. Now, the location was perfect because Verdun sat in a salient, which is the French word for bulge. There is Verdun right in the middle. This would allow the Germans to fire at the city on 3 sides. This was a killing box. Go in and death is coming at you from almost all around. Now, when questions started being asked, Falkenhayn played clever politics. He would assign the crown prince, the Kaiser's eldest son and heir, Wilhelm, who was the commanding officer of the 5th Army, to lead the assault. And his son wanted a big win because he could become a national hero. And he could do something his old man never did, because his old man had Elb's palsy. Actually, sorry, it was the left hand. So he could actually be a military hero. Now, when the prince found out, now by the way, FYI, German nobles didn't automatically get rank. Typically, they were given fake positions. So they got the title, but they didn't actually have command control over their units. Usually what happened is they had an aide with them that went to the military academies and could essentially control the army based on German army standards. But the young prince actually did go to the military academy. So he was not just a celebrity. He actually was well-versed. And he had been in command of the 5th Army since the beginning of the war. So he actually had operational experience. So, when he receives Falkenhayn's plan, he's like, oh yeah, I'm all in. But he noticed one big feature. Right through the middle was the Meuse River. And there's hills here, there's hills here. So the prince says, perfect. I'll move my army into a position where I can take the hills on both banks of the river and use these to rain hell on the city, and we essentially can cut off the salient. But Falkenhayn said, no, that's not what I want. Don't take the west bank, only take the east. because he does not want to capture Verdun. He doesn't want to close the salient. He wants the death box. Now, FYI, if they went with the prince's plan, they could have had Verdun in less than a week.
But that's not what Falkenhayn wants. He is the commander of the general staff, and Falkenhayn's plan goes into effect because he wasn't concerned about winning a battle. William wanted the battle. He wanted the win. Falkenhayn was thinking on the strategic level, killing French.
Now, the city itself was one of those fortress cities.
And on paper, it was one of the most fortified sectors on the entirety of the Western Front. It was a city that had grown up around an ancient citadel, a fortress. And throughout the centuries of its existence, a series of 28 outer forts were built in two rings. This was like Liege. This was like Namur, only it was bigger. In total, the fortress had a circumference of 28 miles. The inner forts were all built at a maximum of 5 miles away from the city. And they were all within somewhere between 1 and 5 miles of the other forts. So that way, the outer forts could give fire support to the inner forts and vice versa. The other point was that the outer points were all built upon elevated, thank you, positions, averaging somewhere between 400 to 500 feet above the valley floor where the citadel sat. So they had the high ground around the whole city. It was so big, it encompassed 12 outer towns, including the towns of Belfort, Epinal, and Toul. Now, Verdun had a history that was actually older than France. Verdun was a Roman town that first entered the history books in the 5th century when Attila the Hun sought to seize Gaul. And the Gallic legions managed to repel Attila, giving him really one of his few losses during his ravenous campaigns.
In 1843, after the death of Charlemagne and Charlemagne's son, Charlemagne's three grandsons decided they can't rule all of the Frankish kingdom. So they made a treaty in 1843 called the Treaty of Verdun, where they literally divided up Charlemagne's empire into three separate kingdoms. One of which would become France, one of which would become Germany, and the other one would become Italy. So Verdun is responsible literally for the formation of Western Europe. It was technically in the German side for 800 years until the crazy religious war, which I'm going to talk about in my early class, the 30 Years' War, when the French marched in, occupied it, seized it, and didn't give it back to Germany. So it's only been technically French since 1648. During the Franco-Prussian War,
Verdun was the last city to hold out other than Paris. It's where the French Second Army would eventually surrender. So this city was always there, and it was always part of big historic events. It was a city of pride, and Falkenhayn knew that.
So he figured this would further help break the morale of the French people, because this would be significant humiliation. The French people would look at their elected officials and they would be embarrassed, humiliated, like we are every time Joe Biden slips and falls.
Now, by the way, would our country lose its mind if Mexico came up and took Los Angeles? No, I would be like, good, you can have it. Take it. Take all of California if you want. Except not Northern California. Take all of Southern California. You can have all that shit. Why did the Germans think that the French would lose their minds?
It's a sign of national pride, so I mean, take a dump on their pride, they're going to get upset. It's going to affect their willingness to fight, because then they look at their government as ineffective, so they're going to say, hey, what are you doing? What's going on?
That's good. That's good. Well, truth be told, the Germans actually viewed the French as hysterical women. So this is the expression they used in their planning. They're like, oh, France is a bunch of women. So they'll basically break down and cry. And when they cry, they'll lose the will to fight. Because they're hysterical. They're emotional. Whereas the Germans are strict. Proud.
Well, here's the thing.
Like I said, it was the most fortified position along the entire Western Front. Because
in the 1880s, after the Franco-Prussian War,
the French invested millions of francs into the modernization of the fortress. The outer forts were modernized and made more resistant to artillery. They had, in total, 79 guns that sat in gun turrets that could raise and lower. The top of this turret is 8 feet thick of concrete and steel. These built into the ground, the shaft itself is 15 feet deep. In between the big guns were smaller machine gun turrets. This gun turret is, if memory serves me correctly, it's surrounded by an outer steel hull that I think is a foot thick, and inside it's concrete. So the gunner only has enough room to get up inside this little tube and put his machine gun out the different gun slots. In total, there were 6 150-millimeter guns. There were 14 twin 75-millimeter guns and countless other smaller guns, mortars, machine guns. And all of the forts were interconnected by tunnels. So you didn't even have to go above ground. And in the tunnels included observation posts, trenches, batteries, command posts, shelters, medical stations. And they were all interconnected originally by telegraph, but eventually replaced to telephone wire.
And as if that was not all enough, there also was a railroad system,
small car railroads, that was built connecting all of the forts inside the defensive perimeter. So long story short,
This wasn't an old-fashioned, we're going to build walls. No, this is, we're going to rain down death upon anyone that dare tries doing a little bit of this.
By the way, that's exactly why the salient formed. Because the Germans understood that Verdun was the most lethal military position on the continent. So, notice, the Crown Prince's Fifth Army, in the original Schlieffen plan, there's Verdun in blue, was supposed to essentially go around it. They were not going to attack the city. They just basically was going to encircle it and starve it out.
But, of course, we know the Schlieffen plan fell and everything was cut short, including the hook around Verdun. But they still had the bulge. Now, during mobilization, one of the reasons why the Germans didn't go after it was because when Joffre was preparing for the war on the frontiers, he actually moved 66,000 soldiers into Verdun and gave them enough supplies and ammunition to hold out for 6 months. And the Germans knew it. But once the war commenced, things changed. Particularly after Joffre got reports of what Big Bertha and those Krupp guns did to Legion No More. Joffre decided, well, why are we going to put all that strength into one sitting target? Joffre in 1914 would make the decision, yeah, if the Germans attack the city, we're not going to send reinforcements. We're not going to hold it at all costs. And after the failed offenses of 1915, Joffre slowly began stripping Verdun of soldiers, guns, ammunition, and supplies because he needed it elsewhere on the line. And here's the greatest irony of them all. Okay, maybe there's one more click. I don't know. I will say it now because I'm not sure if it's going to flip on the next screen. As Verdun is being stripped, Joffre decides, I don't even want to hold it anymore. So, beginning in January 1916, not only did he start stripping all of the guns and all of the munitions and stuff out of the fort, but he began having some of the outer forts packed with explosives. He was planning on blowing up the fortifications and retreating and making trenches outside of Verdun, because it wasn't worth trying to hold.
That doesn't make any sense.
Neither does half the things that Joffre did. He didn't have the men to fully defend the city. So rather than risking the Germans getting fully operational towers and using the towers to fire upon the French L towers, he basically decided, we'll just give it all up. We'll hold it like we do rest of the line. But if they take it, they take it. So, by February, at the same point when everything is moving for the attack, there were less than 300 machine guns and small artillery pieces in the fortress. And the amount of ammunition they had would only allow the men to fire full-blown for 2 weeks. They also removed men, and they were repositioned along the lines. Most of the towers only had in them small maintenance crews, whose job it was just to continue to comb over them and basically pull out anything of value. Before, they also blew up all the railroad tracks because they didn't want to allow the Germans, if they take the city, to use the railroad tracks to get around the fortress. So essentially, they were planning on leaving. And again, they did switch to a linear defense behind the city. They started digging trenches. They started putting up barbed wire. So at the very moment the Germans are planning on going in, the French are planning on going out. Remember what I said when I was talking about 1915. They were convinced that they could get the big breakthrough. So Joffre was focusing on punching the German lines, forcing the Germans to begin retreating, and making the war fluid again. Verdun was a static position.
I guess from that logic, sure. I mean, that again, I can't play backseat.
No, that's the thing. Hindsight's 20/20, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, there it is. Plans to destroy. I knew there was a click. I generally try not letting it go down low as low on the PowerPoint, but obviously, my man, it gets F on this slide. All right, questions? All right. So now let's hop on the other side of the line. The operation code name was Unternehmen Gereich, which in English is Operation Judgment. The planned start, again, literally at the point when the French are packing the towers with TNT, is pretty much at the very exact same time. Falkenhayn planned on launching the attack D-Day, if you will, on February 12, 1916. Now, unlike previous operations, Germany would spend 3 months getting ready for this attack. They first emptied all of the French villages around the salient of civilian population. Because, by the way, that's one of the weird things that happened. The villagers close to the trenches still stayed in their homes. I mean, some fled, but some left. And a lot of them made a lot of money cooking, doing laundry for the soldiers on either side of the line. But this time, for the first time, the Germans didn't want anyone there because they were fearful of spies. Because once the population was removed, all of the buildings would be requisitioned. And into those buildings would be stuffed 600,000 soldiers. They also brought up 1,250 artillery pieces of all different sizes. Based on their estimates, German estimates, they had a 5-to-1 advantage against the French in terms of manpower and a 3-to-1 advantage in artillery. Of course, the one thing they didn't know was that there was like no French there to begin with. Or there was some, but not as many as they expected. They also brought with them a new secret weapon, phosphine gas, which I'll talk about in a little bit. They laid thousands of miles of telephone cables. They constructed underground bunkers to hide, like, the artillery shells and so forth. And just to feed this area, they made 10 new railroad lines.
At the same time as they began moving men in, they took advantage of their air superiority. The Germans would commit 270 planes to patrolling over the salient. And we'll call it aggressive patrols, because the French at the time only had about 70 planes in the region. So there was at all times 5 or 10 German planes in the skies at all time. And whenever they saw a French plane, they formed a pack and they chased them off. Shift after shift after shift after shift. Because they didn't want French recon. The plan was to, again, there's the Meuse River, to attack the salient along an 8-mile stretch. I don't know if Matt in the back, you can see the yellow. The idea again, massive strike, narrow focus. They wanted to maximize the full destructive capability on a small point along the line that they essentially could overwhelm, penetrate, and take the hills as planned. Now, FYI, during the preparation, they would bring in over 4 million artillery shells. Now, unfortunately, when D-Day arrived, bad weather struck. There was fog, there was rain, there was high winds. So the command control units decided to delay the operation. Day after day after day after day until 9 days. But on the 9th day, the weather seemingly broke. At 7:15 a.m., February 21st, I don't know if you can see this one because I couldn't find a really good picture of it. This first gun fired, and by the way, right there is the Crown Prince. This was a massive railroad gun. It was so big it could only be moved on a railroad car. They literally made the set of tracks to put the gun at the right angle to be able to fire at Verdun directly. And at 7:15, the Crown Prince gave the order to fire. According to accounts, that first shell flew into Verdun, hit the bishop's house, and blew the side off of the cathedral in the middle of the city. From that point on, 2/3 of the guns, 800 of them, would open fire. The artillery barrage would last for 9 hours. Over 1 million rounds were fired, making it the heaviest bombardment of the entire war. It was said you could hear it 100 miles away. And what about the French? Well, in a letter that was sent home by a French soldier by the name of Louis Maffray, he described the bombardment as follows, and I quote, I like this, I just had to throw it in. "The shock was terrifying. Those who, like me, were sitting were lifted out of their seats, and those who were standing collapsed. I felt a violent blow to my stomach and my head. The lights went out. The door of the shelter that he was in resonated with a strong gong, and underneath was engulfed by a cloud of dust. Burnt gas seared our throats and our nostrils. No one breathed a word. We then heard big chunks of earth raining down on the shelter above. And then after
seeming eternally, the noise slackened. French positions along the 8-mile front were so devastated that French estimates have 4 out of every 5 soldiers that were either injured or killed. Now, ironically, German reconnaissance was so good, they managed to locate all of the remaining communication lines, all of the telephone poles, and the artillery guns had zeroed in. So they also severed all communication out of Verdun. And they also knew where all the artillery positions were. They hit them as well. One thing I should mention, before they stopped, they also sent phosphine gas rounds at the French artillery positions as well. So that way the French soldiers would be too terrified to come out and try to fire back. We'll call that suppressing fire. Then, after 9 hours, they stopped. But here's the thing. The pause was a ruse. Because when the order to stop was given, half of the German planes were in the air. And as they flew over, they watched for movement of French soldiers coming out of the positions. And they didn't have wireless, but they did have other means of communication, light flashing, because behind the lines the Germans had elevated blimps that could get the signals from the planes. All of the positions where the French soldiers were documented. Because at 4 o'clock, the boots came in. Order to launch the ground assault came at 4 p.m. Leading the charge was a new unit called Stoßtruppen, or the Stormtroopers. These guys were specially trained units. These men had received the most extreme physical fitness training in the ramp up to the use of the unit. These guys didn't charge with rifles. No, 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 no. They charged with grenades, sidearms, and bayonets. Their job was not to hold ground, but to run through the ground, find the enemy wherever they were, and kill them, and then continue to charge. The reserves would bring up the rear and then take the positions.
Didn't they also introduce the first submachine guns in the storm?
Not yet. That would be in 1918. But these guys also had 96 flamethrower teams with them as well. So if the French don't want to come out, we'll toast them inside.
I hate to get shot with one of those on my back.
Oh yeah, I know. You're basically dead.
Yeah.
But again, that's why the first wave went through. And then these guys were right behind.
Yeah, pretty much.
Now, in truth be told, the Germans did manage to take quickly all of the advanced trenches, and they managed to push the line inward. And in fact, in the first 2 weeks, they moved the line 6 miles, which was more than the line had moved anywhere along the Western Front all of 1915. And they continued to charge. 6 miles in 2 weeks. One of the greatest successes they had was when they captured one of the key points that was directly on the outer ring that had the largest firing capability.
Fort Douaumont.
How did they do it? Well, there was a command error. The French did not get a full detailed explanation that came with Joffre's drawdown. In Joffre's orders, he specifically said that Fort Douaumont, because it's the most outlying position, that was the last one to essentially be demobilized. But as it turned out, it was the first one to be demobilized. So when the stormtroopers got to the fort, they literally went to the outside doors, which were not locked, and they marched in. The 24 French maintenance guys, not soldiers, quickly did one of these. And the French lost one of the most important forts. Like that. Now, the German newspapers heralded this as one of the greatest victories of the war to date. Falkenhayn was so drunk with success, he actually told the general staff, many of whom advised that this was not necessarily the wisest strategy. He actually responded, and I quote, with this simple line, "See, with this attack, I was right again." That, my friends, is called hubris. Unfortunately,
after they seized Douaumont, things began to grind to a halt.
From February 28th all the way until mid-June, the Germans would gain only one more mile of territory.
Part of the reasons why was the German advance was so quick,
they outpaced the German artillery. If they had slowed down, the artillery could have been moved forward and they could have continued to rain artillery shells in advance of the German advance. But because all on the other side, the German side of the lines, it was basically all swampland, they couldn't move the guns up. So the guys advanced without artillery cover. And as they advanced, they grew closer to the French guns, which was kind of dumb. Plus, as we're going to see, as this battle began, the Eastern Front would light up. So Falkenhayn basically realized he's going to have to take some of the reserves that he intended on using for Verdun to send into the east. Now here's the kick. I've not read a military historian that has said other than if Falkenhayn stuck with his original plan, he could have easily taken all of the eastern heights and he could have easily achieved his objective. But because he forced the German advance to go at 70% of the original plan, it ran out of gas. Now, if you recall, the whole purpose of this attack is to bleed the French white. So, he actually anticipated that once the battle began, that the French would freak out. Oh, we can't suddenly lose Verdun. And ironically, the French responded like D. He had the response 100% spot on. Joffre, who had been demobilizing the fort, suddenly decides to do a complete 180. He begins giving orders that Verdun is to be held at all costs. Because for propaganda reasons, he wanted to use Verdun as a national symbol of France's struggle for survival. So, if the French managed to hold Verdun, they could hold France. So, surveying the land, he made probably one of the most significant decisions he made of the entire war. He decided to pull the French Second Army from a more western position and move it to Verdun. What makes this significant is the commanding officer, Henri Petain. Now, FYI, just for a little bit of future spoilers, Petain was the man who signed the surrender treaty to Adolf Hitler in a rail car in Compiègne Forest in 1941. But that Petain was still
25 years down the road.
When Petain arrived at Verdun, he immediately went to work. And I have my little PowerPoint screwed up. Oh, poor Henri. Henri's behind the map. Henri should be front and center, but I guess he's not. Oh, well, we don't need to look at his face. All right,
quick background. Petain was a career officer. He joined at the age of 17, and he would remain in the army until he died. But, like many French officers, he joined too late to experience things that were significant. He joined in 1873, 2 years after the Franco-Prussian War came to a conclusion. And from 1873 all the way up to 1900, France did not get into any big wars. So his career progressed slowly. He had served in several light infantry units. And in those units, he was recognized for his intellectual abilities. So he would be given staff or regimental assignments. So he wasn't a grunt. Now, ironically, he never served a single day in his entire career outside of the mainland of France. So all of his military experience came from basically serving in National Guard units. 1900, he was promoted, and he would get a job as a professor at one of France's war academies. And there, he taught advanced infantry tactics. Now, ironically, here's one of the greatest ironies. He himself had served in infantry units, and in the trainings, he suddenly realized that the French army's philosophy of the focus of a furious infantry assault supported by a cavalry assault was stupid. So he was one of the few professors at the War Academy that instead focused on a simple idea. Firepower kills. He focused on the use of artillery to pound the enemy into submission. And then once you do that, you use your infantry and cavalry to mop up. But you fire the big guns before you send the boots. By the way, he would get in such trouble that at one point he was almost fired. And things at the school became so bad that in June 1914, he actually contemplating retirement.
Why? Well, at that point, he was 58 years old, never fought in a major battle. All he did was involved in the suppression of French farmer riots, which were very frequent. And he was like, I'm done. I don't want to do this anymore. But out of sheer luck, his wife convinced him, just teach one more year. So he still was a colonel in a unit brigade. So when the war erupted, his brigade was deployed, and he got a chance to get involved in the race at sea. His first action was during the Great Retreat. That's when the Germans were basically overwhelming the French, if you remember that. And Joffre basically said, yeah, we're not losing, we're just tactfully pulling back. Well, his unit was one of the brigades that got decimated by the Germans so bad that his commanding officer committed suicide. So he was promoted because the big guy was dead. Then, at that point, he became commander of the 32nd Corps and fought during the race to the sea. And eventually, because of his ability to survey battles, he was actually given full command of the Second Army prior to the Second Battle of Champagne. If you recall, he was one of the French analysts that I quoted back in 1915 when he surveyed the damage. And he basically said that a breakthrough was possible if you used enough artillery. So he would put his theories into practice at Verdun. The first thing that he did was establish what is known as defense in depth. Instead of pulling back, he spread his men out evenly along every single defensive position that was held by the French. And he made sure to split his strength not only across the line, but he also wanted to make sure there were adequate reserves. So that way, if something happened at any point, he could move up the next wave to plug the gap. Defense in depth. He also focused on logistics. He deployed his corps of engineers, and they would build up what became known as the Voirie Sacrée, which the French would remember as the Sacred Way. It literally was a string of farmers' roads that stretched for 45 miles that would be all built up with gravel, and it would be leveled and it would be maintained. It was one of the best roads in all of France. It was capable of handling thousands of trucks driving on it a day. And by the way, he used it, and it turned out to be one of the first instances of using motor vehicles, automobiles, trucks, to engage in mass supply in world history. Because the trucks could travel faster than horse-pulled wagons. At its peak, the capacity is estimated to be able to, that road could handle up to 90,000 men being transported by truck per week, plus 50,000 tons of supplies. One wave came in, the other wave went out. You empty, you load, and you switch. Non-stop. So as this battle continued, he never ran out of men. He never ran out of supplies. He also was a weird cat. For a guy that never actually had any combat experience prior
to the start of World War I. When the war began, he actually became a soldier's general. He was one of the few French generals that were concerned about his men. He would develop what became known as the Noria rotation system. Now, by the way, a Noria was an ancient Roman device used to bring water from low positions up to high positions by having integrated water wheels that would scoop up the water at a low point, fill a pan at a midpoint, which then could be scooped up by the next water wheel, brought to the higher point, all the way up to the higher elevated position. Now, don't get me wrong. Petain didn't hesitate to sacrifice his troops, but he came to understand the importance of morale. Because if the soldiers' morale is strong, they would fight harder. What he did, he frequently visited the front line positions. And he was one of the few generals that actually saw the filthy, vile, in fact, this is one of his tours, one of the conditions in the trenches. He saw the men up to their knees in mud, in blood, in crap, in rats. And he realized, I would lose my mind in those conditions. So, to ease the stress, he ordered every single unit along the line to engage in a rotation. Men, at most, were to serve 15 days at the front. Or, if their unit got hit hard and one-third of the strength was diminished, that unit would be rotated out. They would go to the farthest point behind the lines, and they would be given 15 days to recover. Then they would circle up to the third trench line, where they would spend 15 days. Then they would cycle up and go to the second trench. And then eventually they would get back to the front. Now, by the way, the Germans, they left their men in the trench nonstop. There was no rotation. Because the Germans believed that the men would become harder and more fierce under the constant stress. And if you have a guy at the A level, better to keep him at that level than risk him get soft by going to the rear. I mention that because Adolf Hitler tells a story in Mein Kampf when in 1916 he suffered an injury. And he was ordered by his superiors, when they realized he hadn't left the front since 1914, he was ordered to go back home to engage in medical recovery. Well, Hitler goes back and he's in Munich and he sees that anti-war movements are forming, motivated or led by many Jews who refused to volunteer to fight. He was freaking out, and he said in Mein Kampf, granted this was 12 years after the fact, that he knew at that point that the Jews were working on stabbing the Germans in the back by making the German home front soft to demoralize them. So he was so disgusted, he refused to leave the front for the rest of the war. Well, getting back to this, the French had a different perspective. And the Noria system would be part of the reasons why the Verdun, the Battle of Verdun, became a propaganda symbol. Because the French newspapers equated the Noria system with the national will by the French people to fight.
They're going to give it all they can until they can't anymore. And then the next man is going to come up and take his place. And then the next man's going to come up and take his place.
That the French will fight on to the end. Whereas the famous slogan in the newspapers, I got it black, it might come up as a click. Nope, I didn't put it on there. Ils ne passeront pas. They shall not pass became the slogan. All right, last but not least, the French became, ooh, I want that, sorry. I got to get this one because I'm actually going to be down in that area. Come on, quick, I want the money. That's not it, that's my wife. Go away, Mrs. Professor Manic. There we go. Did I miss it? Please don't miss it. I'm literally going to be there so I can get 2-for-1 money. Let's see if they give me more money, though. I'll go cheap, say $150. All right. Sorry, I'm greedy. The fourth thing that he did, artillery. He was an artilleryman. He realized, took note, that the Germans advanced out of the range of their guns. He noticed that the Germans advanced into the range of the French. So, thanks to secured supply lines, he made sure that the French artillery constantly had access to shells. And whenever they had the ability, they would nudge the guns forward. So essentially, he wouldn't use the forts as the defensive perimeter. He would use his artillery as the defensive perimeter. Because the only way that the German guns could take out the French guns was to come in range of the French guns. So in other words, the further the Germans penetrated, the more death they would experience. Firepower kills. France, in the first 5 months of the battle, would fire 1.5 million artillery shells. FYI, the French artillery crews had more experience in those 5 months than soldiers in any army on earth that had been career men. Because they were firing their guns every single day of the week. And they got so good, they could almost hit anywhere they wanted to with a near-perfect hit. It is just insane. Questions? So now you have the Germans giving everything they can to push forward to create the death zone, and you have the French doing everything they can to impose death upon the French. Sadly, as the days went by, this battle began consuming men like an insatiable beast. Day after day after day, there was death. Conditions. Oh, I wish this was a bigger screen. These are some really good pictures. Conditions were unimaginable. Because it rained frequently. The tracks would be so deep. Look, it's up to the horse's hips. The men, conditions in the trenches. This is just mud that would just melt whenever it rained. And notice, every article of possession they have is there. And usually the stuff of the guys that died stayed there. And oftentimes, sometimes the corpses stayed there as well, because there was no place to put it. Again, here's an example of some guys after a rainstorm. So in order to get out of the rain, they dug their trench, or into their trench, to hide from the rain.
but notice the mud. The mud from the other side poured in so high, they're sitting in mud up to their waist. Trees completely devastated. Again, millions of artillery shells blowing everything sky high. And out of all the pictures that are synonymous with Verdun, this is the one that strikes me the most. This is a guy that is dead. He's dead. He looks like he's sitting. He stayed in no man's land for 2 months because his buddies, he's a French soldier, were too afraid to get out of the trench to get him because they didn't know, is it going to be a French round that's going to come down or is it going to be a German round?
Missed something. I'm not going to continue there. We're not going to continue there. I forgot one line. Rumors of mutiny began to spread. I guess we could put it under the conditions are imaginable.
It got so bad that Pétain would have to issue orders that any deserter was to be shot on sight. No questions asked. There are dozens of stories of soldiers trying to sneak out of the trench to go a little farther behind so they could take a dump. But they were out of their position that was judged to be insubordination and they were shot.
Pétain was determined to hold the line at all costs. Questions? All right, well, I'm done with you. Papers, papers, papers. Now, we're going to come back. We're going to finish Verdun on Tuesday. And then we're going to start the Battle of the Somme. And then we're going to go on Easter, and then we're going to come back and we'll see what took place on the Eastern Front, as well as what took place on the Southern Front. And then we'll have our next exam. So chances are the week after Easter will be exam number 3. I love it. Everyone's just trying to run out as I was trying to finish my last thought. That kid's name's Jacob. And that kid right in front of me is named Kevin. How did I miss you? Oh, because I got the people in the back.
Stay in the shed, but my shirt's coming in and going soon.
Oh.